This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Rex Holbein, founder and creative director of Facing Homelessness, a nonprofit directed toward inviting all of us to come closer and to contribute our unique passions and skills toward the effort of ending homelessness. Rex Holbein is here to tell us about the work of Facing Homelessness and to give us a status report on the Block Project. Welcome, Rex.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What led to your efforts to address homelessness? Would you give your personal story?
Sure. You know, I'm an architect. I was actually born and raised here in Seattle and had an architectural practice for about 28 years doing really high-end residential architecture exclusively. And I had moved my office to the Fremont neighborhood and began to meet a lot of people that were living outside down by the canal. And, you know, there were a lot of in-between stories that I could go into, but really in short, what was happening for me with each person that I was meeting is that they were not matching up to the negative stereotype that we all seem to hold culturally about people that are homeless. In fact, the very opposite. I was meeting people that were wonderfully interesting, brilliantly smart, had varying degrees of education, some very accomplished, some that had held down really great jobs, and had found themselves through some personal circumstance suddenly homeless. And that idea that it was not what I thought it was really brought me kind of deeper into it. And at the same time, I was having conversations with my clients who are all typically millionaires, and at the very same time, having conversations with people that were homeless who had nothing to their name. And that, too, that discrepancy between the two also asked me to kind of go a little deeper. Out of that kind of internal discussion, I started a Facebook page called Facing Homelessness, you know, with the sole intent of looking closer, of sharing black and white photos and telling stories of people that are homeless on the streets, just to get closer.
Would you tell the story of Chiaka?
Chiaka was a man that was sleeping in the bottom of a cart parked out front of my office. In fact, two carts. One was filled with art, his art, and the other was filled with his personal belongings, including him sleeping in the bottom shelf. I rode my bike in on the Burke-Gilman Trail and got off my bike and noticed him there, and I tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Hey, when you wake up, you can come into my office to have a cup of tea and we can chat if you'd like." And he kind of from underneath his blanket said, "Sure, okay," you know, didn't look out. But a few hours later, he knocked on the door, and we struck up this conversation, and he asked me if I wanted to hear a children's book story that he was writing, and three quarters of the way through it, I began to tear up. And out of that, I offered him the shed that was outside of my office to store his art and ultimately to live in. And that really began a very close personal relationship with him, one that led to me showing his artwork on a Facebook page ultimately that one of his daughters found from Pittsburgh, and he had left 10 years before when she was just 8 years old, and, you know, ultimately had him reunite with his family because of it.
What is the mission of Facing Homelessness?
So the mission of Facing Homelessness, which really grew out of this awareness that I was experiencing, which was the closer that you come to this issue, the more you feel, the more you feel, the more you act. It's a pretty simple formula. So Facing Homelessness specifically identifies this notion that we, if we're really realistic about this, if we're serious, we're not going to end homelessness unless we all get involved. We cannot expect that we're going to hear the grand solution on the evening news one night. You know, we're ending homelessness, and somehow it's happening without our involvement. So if that's true, if we need community to get involved to end homelessness, Facing Homelessness as a nonprofit is creating ways for all of us to come closer, safe, easy entry points, believing that once you start, your own human nature, your own human compassion will actually start to open up and bring whatever your creative solution is to help take part in the solution. So we have a number of projects that we have started in this effort. One is to just say hello, to do the very simple thing that we all know how to do with each other, to make eye contact, give a smile, reach out to just say hello to someone that's suffering on the streets. There are so many opportunities for this, right? Coming down off the freeway off-ramp, you can lower your window and just say something beautifully kind to that person, like, "Hey, I love your smile. You know, I saw you three cars back, and I just want to let you know that, and I hope you're doing okay." We can use our own human compassion to begin the process of healing for people. that's in essence the work of Facing Homelessness, is to just bring us all closer in a safe, comfortable way so that we can begin our journey.
Before we focus in more detail about the Block Project, would you give an overview of your programs? You mentioned the Facebook page, for example.
The Facebook page basically now has 47,000 people following it, and it primarily shares the stories of people that are outside. And I would say, you know, roughly half of those posts on that page ask for something for that person that's on the street. And one of the really beautiful statistics about having run this now for 7 years is that every single request that we have made for those on the street has been met by this community, often within the first hour to 2 hours. It's this beautiful empathy wishing well, to be honest. And those asks range from something as simple as a tent or a sleeping bag to getting someone's car that was impounded, that was actually their home, taken away from them, you know, could be $1,500. All of those asks have been met immediately by this community. But we have a lot of other projects that we've done, such as the Feel Good Project, which was started by somebody in our community that is a hairstylist. And that grew, I think we've done it 7 or 8 times now, and that's grown into include attorneys, doctors, veterinarians, acupuncturists, foot care, all of this to just bring people closer again to those that are living outside. We had a project called the Street Heart Project, where artists came and drew the photos I've been taking of folks that are outside, again, just to put a beautiful, humanizing face on this issue. You mentioned the Block Project, which is really kind of the very extreme extension of Just Say Hello, again, coming closer. And in this project, we're actually have designed the small 125-square-foot homes that go in the backyards of people's residential lots, again, just to come closer to those that are suffering through homelessness.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Rex Holbein, founder and creative director of Facing Homelessness. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. Let's focus now in detail on the Block Project. You've started to allude to it, but would you tell us about the Block Project and why you chose this approach to address homelessness?
Sure, yeah. So I'm an architect, and one of my daughters, Jen Lafreniere, is also an architect, and we began to talk about how could we as architects actually get involved to make a difference? And this is a really important question, I think, for all of us to ask, because we all have something to offer. It doesn't have to be this very conventional way of addressing homelessness, like working at a shelter or going to the food bank. We believe strongly that if you come with your passion and your skills, you can make a profound difference. And if you are passionate about it, you also will stick to it, right? Very important part of actually getting involved is staying with it. So we began to expand on this idea that Facing Homelessness had with proximity, about really coming closer, because every time we do, it changes us. So that grew into the idea that we could design these very small homes to go into backyards as a way for the whole block to get involved, not just the person that is opening their backyard, but the entire block. And in doing that, we take the overwhelming nature of homelessness, which is, you know, in King County, 11,643 people counted this year. And we break that down for 20 to 25 people to one person. And suddenly it becomes something very manageable, something of a human scale that we can begin to open up to. There's a lot of components to this project. For instance, it was important that these are not just sheds, that they actually are a dignified place to live. They have a kitchen, a bath, a bed, you know, storage, and a covered porch, actually. It's important that we can all say, you know, I would live there, right? I'm not just giving something as shelter. We must do a lot more than just provide shelter, especially for those that are trying to heal, that are trying to come back into community, into society, where currently they're seen as other. That's actually a very important component of this. This is an integrated solution. It's great to give housing to people, even tent cities or small house villages. But in the end, we need to break down the separation. We need to see all of us as equal, and that means that we need to provide dignified places to live for each of us.
Would you just underscore the goal of the Block Project?
It's a great question. Thank you for asking that, because a lot of times people confuse what Facing Homelessness is doing as helping people that are outside. And in fact, what Facing Homelessness is doing is helping people that are already living inside, helping them to open up, to get engaged, to listen to your heart about how to address and make a difference for those that are suffering. So the goal of the Block Project really is to bring all of community into the equation of ending homelessness. And the byproduct of that is really to help end homelessness. If we can open up, you know, the space of our backyards, and that's an important component because space, land is a really difficult part of this. We provide a big part of the missing link already. If we put one on every single block, as we plan to, we more than enough provide housing to end homelessness.
Would you say more about what the block cottages are like? I understand they're off-grid as well.
They are. This is, you know, one of the other very important components of creating healthy community is that we not only need to take care of each other, we all know we need to take care of the planet, right? And so these homes are completely off-grid. They have solar panels for all of the power. They have rain catchment and purification for all of the water uses, including drinking, and takes care of all of the sewage needs on site. So it has a composting toilet for black water and a subsurface irrigation for the gray water that comes from the sink and the shower. We're very fortunate to have the International Living Future Institute helping us get what's called Living Building Challenge certification. And this is a really big deal because it is the most stringent certification for living green, for being as sensitive to the planet as we can, comprised of actually seven petals. I don't need to go into all of this, but it's a very holistic way to live in community on this planet. And we hope to have each one of these being Living Building Challenge certified as well.
How do you find homeowners who are willing to have a block home built in their backyards?
I'll start by saying we have four families that are currently matched up with residents that we're working with. It's kind of our first four pilot program. But we have over 75 families now that have already said yes in my backyard that they want to proceed with this project. 75 families without having asked yet. So we're pretty excited about that. The process currently is that people just hear about the project through media like this, but also through word of mouth. It's a very community centered project. And when you do that, you quickly spread out to a lot of other people. You know, somebody might have come to help build Bobby's first home and then told a friend, and then a friend tells a friend. So that's so far is how we're bringing people to the project.
For the people that have signed up to be hosts for block homes, do they concentrate in any particular part of the city?
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that we're excited about in the pilot program is that the homes are in Crown Hill, in Greenwood, so two north of the cut, and then Central District and Beacon Hill, two homes south of the cut. And they also have a beautiful spread of age. There is a couple in their 30s, a couple in their 40s and 50s, in their 60s, and in their 80s. So we have, you know, really a beautiful disbursement across the age bracket as well.
To what extent are the concerns of neighbors taken into account in deciding whether to build a block home on a given site?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and actually is the reason that we called it the Block Project. So we're not just approaching a homeowner and saying, hey, you very caring, loving person, are you willing to put a home in your backyard for someone that is without? Rather, what we want to do is go to the whole block and make sure that everyone is involved at whatever level they want to be involved. But very specifically, if one person is against this on the block, then we don't do it. The idea is that, you know, we're not looking to take somebody off the street who is currently uncomfortable and struggling, only to put them in housing on a block to make someone that's already living there uncomfortable. This is not about trading comfort, right? This is about building healthy, loving community. And that means that all the way along on this project, we're not looking to create any opposing force. If someone has a problem with what we're doing, we want to sit down and talk with them, go through the explanation. Often the whole NIMBY movement is really, quite frankly, based in fear of what could happen. But once we explain how this project has so many parts and pieces to it, such as services to those that are moving in, a lot of that just melts away. But even yet, if someone says that they don't want this on their block, for whatever reason, we don't shame that person. We say, that's okay, right? You know, we'll move to the next block. And our hope is that once this becomes normal to help people that are suffering by using backyards, that we will bring people that were first a little bit hesitant, we'll bring them forward. There's actually a really good example of this. If you think about before Airbnb, the idea of inviting someone, a complete stranger, into your home to spend the night while you slept, inconceivable. I mean, that would have been crazy. But now we don't give a second thought to that. Airbnb has shifted that. And now, I think that I heard there are over 6,000 Airbnb units in Seattle, right? So clearly, the tide has turned on that. We somehow are no longer worried, and we feel the same thing will happen for our backyards, but in a much more profound way, in a way where we can reach out and help people that are struggling.
For your first four pilot projects, what kind of response have you gotten from the neighbors in those communities?
All four blocks are completely on board, everyone. It's been extremely supportive. In fact, the first home on Beacon Hill for Bobby, who is a Native American 75-year-old man that was homeless on the streets of Seattle for 10 years, you know, the three neighbors that are adjacent to the backyard are all thrilled, right? So it's been this very community-building experience for everyone.
You are attuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Rex Holbein, founder and creative director of Facing Homelessness. How do you choose the tenants for your block homes?
So the tenants have to all come through case management. So currently we're working with Sophia Way, Chief Seattle Club, Mary's Place, and the Community Psychiatric Clinic. All of them basically get the applications from the host families, and that they then go through a process of matchmaking. Once they have done that with the potential resident, then they contact the host and they say, you know, we think this is a good match. And at that point, the host family and the resident meet. This is a very important distinction in this process, because it would be easy to look at this and say, this is a landlord-tenant relationship, right? I mean, this is a business thing, and that's what we're all used to. But in fact, that is not what we're setting up here. We're setting up a friendship. And the people that are coming to it, opening their backyards, see it that way. And the people that are moving into the backyards see it that way. We believe that this is actually what's the center of why this is going to be successful, is that we're matchmaking, really.
Would you tell us about the hosts and tenant for your first block house in the Beacon Hill neighborhood?
Well, we have said an uncountable number of times that we probably could not have found a more perfect host family and a more perfect resident. Now, maybe, you know, I'm an optimist, and maybe we're just super excited about how this is all unfolding. But Dan and Kim, who own the home on Beacon Hill that opened their backyard, are unbelievably remarkable people. You know, they identified themselves, first of all, as introverts, and they were worried about their privacy. And the reason this is important is that we all are going to have worries about this. We're shifting a paradigm here, right? But more important to them than even the worry was this resolve to find a solution. And they worked through that. We have a landscape architect that's been donating, you know, all of the services, landscape design services, for free, and has worked through a design that will allow some separation, some privacy through landscape. But Dan and Kim have allowed hundreds and hundreds of people to come into their backyard to help build this. That means hundreds and hundreds of people have gone into their house and used their bathroom. They've just opened their lives, and they share very openly how this has changed them. It would be very easy to look at this project and say, wow, what a thing for Bobby, right? Like, wow, this life has been changed. That's the obvious. But really what's surprising is how much it changes the host family, how their meaning in their life and their purpose, what they're doing, has come front and center stage. And all the people that are around Bobby, Dan, and Kim feel that. You know, they come to the site, they do this volunteer work, and they're just taken by the glow of it all. It's quite remarkable. I haven't experienced anything in my life like this, how beautiful it is to see community coming together in a compassionate, giving way.
So who owns the block home once it's been built?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have a legal team that's also doing pro bono work for us, that we went around and around on that very question, because it has some property tax assessment implications and other liability issues. So the way it ultimately was set up is that Facing Homelessness owns the block homes, and that there is an agreement with the landlords to use the property for that use.
How long can a tenant stay in a block home?
I'm glad you asked that, because one of the things that happens for people that get housed, that have been chronically on the street, mm-hmm. and they get housing, a lot of times those come with conditions and terms, right? You can have this housing for a year. One of the problems that we have is that people heal at different rates. And the moment a person moves into housing and they know they have 1 year, On day one, they start worrying about day 365. Uh-huh. On day two, they worry a little bit more. And as they march closer and closer to that date, they go through a high degree of stress and trauma, really knowing that they very well could be re-entered into homelessness. Mm-hmm. So we very early on said that we are not going to put terms on the amount of time someone can stay there. If someone heals at 14 months and we kick them out at 12, we've just added to the problem. So the homes are small. They're 125 square feet. We believe that when someone gets on their feet and begins to make life connections and starts to have their needs taken care of by services, that they will self-select out. There will be a moment in time, whether that's in 9 months or a year and a half or whatever, and it'll be different for every person, where they will say, you know, I think I'm ready to move to something a little bit bigger. We believe these are beautiful and dignified places to live, but they're small. They have a kitchen, bath, sleeping, storage, and all that is fit into 125 square feet.
How much does a block home cost?
So the cost for a home, and this is mostly materials cost because nearly all the labor has been donated and will continue to be donated, is somewhere in the $27,000 to $31,000, $32,000, depending on the various sites and on the donations, right? Like, for instance, the first block home, the material for the siding and the roof, the metal siding and metal roofing, was both donated materials and labor. Now, maybe in the future, we might only have the labor donated and we'll have to pay for the siding. But somewhere in that, I would say $30,000 range is what each home will come in at. And most of that is because it's very systems oriented. These are cutting edge, state of the art systems with regards to solar and water catchment and sewage treatment.
Where does the funding come from?
The funding comes from community at this point. You know, it is a completely community-funded, community-built, and community-supported project. We believe that there is this great strength in having the community own this. The way we set up the funding is that we ask for team leaders, and each team leader is asked to raise $35,000 to build one of these homes. And what they do is then they go to family and friends and workmates and their whole circle of influence to raise enough money to put one person, you know, that was on the street into a housing situation.
How do you see the project being brought to scale? What steps do you plan to take?
So that's a really great question. We are currently in conversations with King County and the City of Seattle about this idea of scaling. The county is hoping to help us with warehouse space so that these, I didn't explain this earlier, but these homes, while they're built on site, they are also prefabbed in panels off site. And the first four were scheduled to be built in the Turner warehouse, Turner Construction, one of the many companies that have come to us and provided their services. I can't say enough about Turner Construction and what they've done for this project. But we built the first one panelized in their warehouse and then brought it to the site and assembled it there. The idea is that we will mass produce these that way in a larger warehouse eventually to help scale, and that we are bringing contractors in, not just Turner, but we want to bring in contractors all across the city that will come in and say, hey, I'll build one or I'll build two or whatever their capacity is. We find that the construction community is really ready for this. You know, we've had nothing but positive response from general contractors and subcontractors.
Are there efforts similar to the Block Project in other parts of the U.S.?
We don't know of any projects that are similar other than Multnomah in Portland. Multnomah County is doing something similar in the sense that they are looking to build detached accessory dwelling units in backyards at the cost of around $75,000, I think was the number. And if I have this right, they would ask the homeowner to house someone that's homeless for 5 years, and then after that 5 year period, the home would be theirs to do as they wish. So where we differ from them on this is that we still see that as being set up as kind of a business transaction. You know, there is an incentive to do this for 5 years so that you get this ready-made house that you could use for an Airbnb or whatever at the end of that time. We don't want to start with a business model. We want to start with a compassion, love model. And again, that's nothing negative to Multnomah County. It's just saying that we believe that we can take this further when we bring people to it that aren't looking for monetary gain.
What happens if a homeowner wants to back out?
Right. And there could be a lot of reasons for that. Let's say that that relationship falls apart, which, you know, all relationships have that potential. But also, like, what if that person decides to move? Or other situations. Maybe they have a couple kids and suddenly they need the backyard for different uses, whatever the arrangement is. We basically have a exit strategy where we will just come in and take the house down, rehouse the person that's the resident into another block home, and take the home down and move it to another site.
If someone wants to explore having a block home on their property, how should they proceed?
Well, thank you for asking that. That's a great question. They should contact Facing Homelessness, the nonprofit, and they can do that either at facinghomelessness.org or at the-block-project.com. Both of those places can give you information on how to get involved. And I would say specifically ask for Sarah Stylin, our community director, who is helping bring new host families into the process.
What advice do you have overall for listeners who would like to help end homelessness?
You know, I think the very overlooked giant part of the equation for ending homelessness is community, is each and every one of us. And I would like people to not think of this as a homelessness crisis, but rather to think of it as a community crisis. And I think if you just go through this little exercise in your head, if you say homelessness crisis, I think we all tend to think of it something over there, like outside of us. But if we say community crisis, we're suddenly a part of it, right? And we have to know that this is a community crisis where very compassionate, good people, who I believe we all are walking past people suffering every single day. Something's wrong, deeply wrong with that. And I would say to begin your own personal journey, to see your place in it, to know, to empower yourself to be a part of the solution, I would encourage you to go to our Facebook page, follow us there, read the stories, use that as a introduction to this issue. Begin by making eye contact, by just saying hello, and letting your own compassion lead you to where you need to go to be a part of the solution. Now, that may be the Block Project, but it might be somewhere else that strikes your heart. It could be Mary's Place, could be any number of the beautiful organizations in this city that are trying to compassionately address this issue of homelessness.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would like everyone to know that we are going to end homelessness, and it begins by believing it, and it begins by finding your own part in it. I would also say, consider this idea of opening your backyard to a block home. If you want to know more about that, contact us. We can share all the joy and beauty that we've experienced seeing this unfold.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You were just listening to Rex Holbein, founder and creative director of Facing Homelessness. For more information, check on the web at facinghomelessness.org and theblockproject.com. That's the-block-project.com. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and at kexp.org.